Could I welcome everybody to this session of the Darwin Seminars, now I think in their 10th month of life, and begin with one or two very small announcements. First of all, when it comes to the discussion, I'm glad to say that there are now mobile microphones available. So could I ask anyone who would like to say something at the end, first to raise their hand, and then when the microphone is brought to them, to identify themselves, and I think, if possible, stand up to take part in the discussion. I shan't waste any time introducing the speakers to you, because they're not only world-famous figures in their own fields, but also very much more familiar participants of Darwin Seminars than I am, so it would be presumptuous to do so. But I will say a word about their subjects. We have today, first of all, a presentation on a specific and, in every sense of the word, peculiar form of warfare. Peculiar in that it's unique, culture-specific, and very odd. And this is what Gary Runciman is going to be talking about before the tea interval. Afterwards, we have a much more generalized presentation on warfare as a whole, and particularly, I think, modern warfare. The common theme, it's perhaps too early to predict, but I nevertheless venture the suggestion that it is going to be the cultural factors behind warfare that will unite the two presentations and give unity to the seminar as a whole. So first then, may I ask Gary Runciman to address us on three levels of selection, the case of hoplite warfare.
I'd like to begin, if I may, with two disclaimers. The first is that I've got nothing novel to say. I've got no new findings, no daring hypotheses, no refutations of conventional wisdom. And the second disclaimer is that I'm talking about something which I'm far from being an expert, and indeed I only know a fraction of what our chairman could tell me. And I was lucky enough to have a very quick last-minute supervision, half an hour before the seminar, just to make sure I wasn't going to make some appalling howlers, which I still may, which I hope he can be persuaded kindly to intervene in the discussion and put me right. So all I'm really trying to do is to convince you all that this particular form of warfare is an interesting form of warfare to look at in the context of a Darwin seminar, or perhaps to put it a little bit more vividly, I shall be very content if at the end of it I've persuaded Anthony Snodgrass that the hoplites, which he knows so much about, are a suitable topic for a Darwin seminar, and if I can persuade Robert Hind that hoplites are a suitable topic for a Darwin seminar. So here goes. I've put up a few incidental remarks by some acknowledged experts on the topic, from which you can see that indeed this form of warfare has been and still is regarded as in some ways peculiar. But having said that, I actually want to distance myself quite explicitly from the presuppositions behind those remarks. I am talking to you as a comparative sociologist, and as such, I am almost inescapably committed to the view that any one pattern of well-documented human social behavior is no more peculiar than any other. The question is simply how to explain it as best we can on the evidence that we have. And when people talk about curious or anomalous forms of behavior, in this context, what I assume it means or ought to mean is observations which are anomalous within a body of reasonably well-tested theory. Again, I don't want to digress and betray my ignorance. I know these were within department of the history and philosophy of science, but the, to my mind, to talk about an anomalous or curious piece of behavior. Well, let me give an example. If I've not misread Helena Cronin's Ant and the Peacock, it would be true to say that in the context of current neo-Darwinian theory, the sterility of hybrids is curious. In other words, there is a problem vis-a-vis contemporary theory. But I put those up there because it does give you an impression of just how curious, from their various points of view, many people who've studied this form of warfare do regard Greek hoplites. Now, for those of you who wonder what on earth they were and what this style of fighting is, just two slides I'm going to put up, both of which I owe to Anthony Snodgrass, who has reproduced them himself in publications of his own, and to whom all questions in the discussion should be addressed about them and exactly what they mean. But the first one is to show, and I won't go into the authenticity or the provenance, because it really doesn't affect my point, but I'd just like to draw your attention down at the bottom, indeed duplicating what's at the top, but down at the bottom you see the whole of what I think is known conventionally as a Corinthian-style helmet, which was standard, and you will see it does afford a great deal of protection, but at the same time it narrows the angle of vision, and that's important. You also see that there are two spears, which are or were presumably at that period the part of the normal equipment of the Greek hoplite meaning somebody who carries a particular round shield, and the easiest English translation is perhaps a heavy infantryman as opposed to a light-armed infantryman. And the armament consists of those two spears. The shaft would be made of ash, I think, and that's not, of course, as strong as it might be, so that when you were actually getting to grips, the chances, if you didn't inflict the kind of flesh wound you were after on your opponent, it might well break against the opponent's shield. You then had your short, people writing in English translate the standard Greek term as a sword and some as dagger. It was a short sword, but again, the point is it's a stabbing weapon with which you find yourself face to face with your opponent in a hoplite battle. Well, what was a hoplite battle? The only, the best, and as you can see, it's not as good as we would like it to be, a representation, which comes, I think, from about 650 BC in Corinth. But unquestionably, the artist is depicting the kind of warriors that we are talking about. Now, like so many of these finds, it raises as many questions as it solves, and there's a large literature, which I've only nibbled at, where specialists disagree with each other, and I, of course, believe the last one I read when I was trying to find that one, as to did they all carry two spears, did they throw one, was one a spare, is the artist really trying to represent something for real, or is it purely symbolic? What is the role of the flute player in the middle? Does that mean that Greek hoplites actually advanced to battle in step, or was he merely there making noises on his flute to encourage them? And so on and so forth. But there they are. They have got those Corinthian helmets. They are marching more or less shoulder to shoulder. And a point which is crucial and brought out very clearly in a well-known passage of Thucydides about hoplite warfare is that if you're on a piece of fairly open, level ground, you are marching shoulder to shoulder with people who also have the shield on their left arm and the spear in their right hand. You are therefore exposed on the right flank. And it was standard when two hoplite armies came together, which maybe those are being represented as doing and maybe they're not. But again, please, questions to Professor Snodgrass at the end. The tendency for people always to edge to try and get the maximum protection from the person whose shield is next door to them. Now, there they are. I can rustle them up again later if anybody in the discussion would like to go back to them. But that's the best, I think, that can be done on the basis of this famous archaeological find, to show a contemporary description of the kind of people whom we are actually talking about. So, in summary, and I'll be as quick as I can on this to get onto my own more important point, but that's the best I can do to summarize the distinctive features of this form of warfare. Circular shield, which I've already described, the Corinthian helmet, which you saw, body armor, which you saw, the spears, which you saw, and the spear, or the main spear, which they kept in their hand, had, there are two or three Greek words for it, but this rather funny English translation appears to be standard. A butt spike was a thing like this. It was metal. You could either use it to stick the spear in the ground, which appears to be what's going on in the case of the vase painting that you saw, or, of course, if you'd broken it against your opponent's shield, you still had a stabbing weapon. And possibly, if you were winning and you were moving forward over the wounded bodies of your enemies, you could use it to finish them off. So it was part of the panoply. And the short swords, which, as I say, some people call daggers, but they look a little bit longer to me than that. Tactics. Here are two armies, phalanxes, perhaps is the better word, moving towards each other. The commander has an obvious choice. He can either go for the depth of the column, and sometimes people deliberately did, so that you have this solid column of men, a tremendous weight, which is going to push either against the enemy's column or to break the enemy's line. And again, there are a lot of well-attested technical terms in the Greek for this. Or you might deliberately try and extend the line in order to encircle the opposing army. That was the basic choice. It could, of course, be affected by the choice of terrain. In one particular famous battle, there was actually a watercourse on each side, and obviously that affects the tactics and the course of the battle, and it may affect what happens afterwards when the defeated side tries to run away. And then you've also got Greek armies, not always, but sometimes might use both peltasts, which is the technical term for light-armed infantry. They would have javelins or slings, but they could inflict quite a lot of damage, particularly if they got to the exposed flank of a hoplite army. And there was some cavalry, which is odd in a way, because the terrain of Greece is almost ideally unsuited to cavalry warfare. And if you read purely, as I've been doing, on an anecdotal basis, the descriptions that you get of battles or engagements where cavalry are brought in, sometimes they seem to have been decisive, sometimes they seem to have been a damn nuisance, and sometimes it seems as if a well-disciplined force of hoplites could actually withstand the equivalent of a cavalry charge. More important for my theme is to try and convey what it actually felt like. I put comradeship there, in the sense that that's a platitude about warfare and battle. But you do have people going out at we don't know what intervals, but going out expecting to be called out with their friends, neighbours, contemporaries, marching sometimes for quite long periods, carrying their equipment with them to where the battle would take place. In other words, all the conditions for very considerable solidarity between the fighting men on both sides. Ritual, there's a huge literature on this. Again, no surprise, I think. I mean, the rituals are very different from what you find in other armies at other times and places, but that a great deal of ritual surrounds combat, or whatever is the general word, is going to be no surprise to anybody. There are some interesting features. Again, I'm no expert. I did consult the writings of who I think is the leading contemporary expert on Greek religion, Professor Walter Burkert, and he paints a very explicit picture of, among other things, these hoplite armies going to battle with driving herds of animals which are there purely for sacrificial purposes. And there's a great deal of reference in the literary sources to the sacrifice at various stages, but particularly a form of sacrifice for which the term, there's a specific term, sphagia, that it appears to be normal actually to cut the throat of a living animal and immediately before engaging in combat, then the close order advance, which I've described already, you would move forward as a hoplite in a column of variable width and depth towards a similar column coming the other way. When you did meet, you might have a wonderful breakthrough. Sometimes the other side would panic and run away before getting into the killing zone, to use the phrase that John Keegan has popularized. But very often at the end, there you were, eyeball to eyeball, as they say, and your survival depended on whether you got one or other of your stabbing weapons into somebody else's exposed flesh, or whether he got to yours first. And finally, I put casualty rates, because interestingly, for the set-piece battles, which are documented in our sources, we have got what the experts do seem to regard as convincingly reliable casualty figures. Again, no surprise that in these small communities where people did know each other, the individual casualties by name, there were various methods, or appear to have been, for making sure that you checked up, you know, who had been killed, for getting the bodies, recovering the bodies, burying them sometimes there, more often returning them, making sure that the relatives were informed. And on the basis of what, as I say, does seem to be regarded as pretty reliable evidence, for these battles which are documented over a period of, I suppose, about a couple of hundred years, the figures come out at if you won, you had a 5% chance of being killed, and if you were on the losing side, you had a 14% chance of being killed. Now, that's not negligible, but it's not high by comparison with some other times and places, and it's not high if the evidence is reliable. And again, I'm even less expert here, but my impression is that it's a picnic compared to what happened during the period of Roman expansion by conquest, or in battles of which the most famous against the Carthaginians. So that in Roman warfare, as far as we know, it seems safe to guess that casualty rates were very significantly higher. Now, whether you regard 4% and 15% as between winners and losers as high or low is, of course, up to you. And what we don't know is whether it was higher or lower in all the other battles or skirmishes that we don't know about, or where we know that there was a battle but we don't know what the casualty figures were. But it's a suggestive number, I think. Then finally, but I want to be as quick as I can about this, not quite true, but what I'm trying to summarize there is the reasons for which so many generations of experts on military history have said this is a curious form of warfare. I don't find it that surprising, but I don't want to go into that unless somebody wants to raise it in the discussion. But these weren't wars of conquest. I mean, in the most famous case, when after the long years of the Peloponnesian War, when Sparta finally triumphs over Athens, the one thing that doesn't happen is the Spartan army, you know, marching into Athens, laying it waste, massacring all the inhabitants, and doing what the Romans, at the end of the day, did to Carthage. It's not true there was absolutely no out-of-season campaigning, but these were not year-round wars of attrition. It was not as if once you were called out as a hoplite, you were like, let's say, a Soviet soldier in the Second World War, where you might literally not see your nearest and dearest, even if you survived, until the end of the war. And if that was 5 years, well, that was 5 years, and completely different. That's taking an extreme example the other way. But it does, I think, make the point. No siege craft. I mean, there were sieges. You might have your army around a neighboring polis or little town. And there's a very famous siege described by Thucydides, siege of Plataea at the beginning of the Peloponnesian War, and there are other sieges in the so-called classical period of hoplite warfare. But again, very different from the kind of warfare in which what it's all about is investing, in that technical sense, the enemy's town, mining and digging and, of course, bombarding if you had missiles and projectiles. You start to get a bit of that at the end of the period when there are still hoplites doing the infantry fighting. But by and large, it's not a feature of hoplite warfare. And again, it's not that there were no scouts, ambushes, or guerrillas, but it was unusual. And again, totally different from the kind of warfare in similar terrain, which you get, say, in Spain during the Peninsular War, where the fact that the inhabitants of a territory in which there is a hostile army are constantly doing those kinds of things, spying on it, knocking off a few stragglers with such weapons as they have, leading them deliberately into places in which separate detachments can be ambushed on a year-round basis. Very different. But the main point I want to make, and is what I'll be coming back to, is I hope what I've said gives you some feel for the kind of experience that this kind of fighting was. And as again, perhaps just worth making the point, it was all done by healthy, young, adult males. In certain cases, you will find references to older, I mean to veterans, as it were, being called out. They would normally be called out on guard duty than actually to do the fighting. The one thing which is absolutely no trace is any woman ever engaged in combat in this part of the Greek world. The Amazons were a myth. They may have been a myth based on encounters by Greeks with other peoples, where women may have done the fighting, but as far as the Greek world, in the sense that I'm using it here, is concerned, out of the question. The only thing you get in that same period early in the Peloponnesian War, when a Theban detachment of hoplites, I think it is actually trapped, for reasons that I don't need to go into, inside the town of Plataea, and the population turns against them. There's a very vivid description in Thucydides of the women of the town taking to the rooftops and screaming and yelling and throwing roof tiles and stones down on these soldiers armed as you described. I thought if they knew where it was coming from and faced the right way, they would be fairly well protected. But that's the only case, certainly, that I can think of. It's as near as women ever get to combat in the hoplite world. Now, in my remarks, I'm going to rely almost entirely on the testimony of the two historians, Thucydides and Xenophon, and I think they are reliable witnesses, if only because we know that they had both done it themselves. They did know exactly what they were talking about. Thucydides was an Athenian strategos up in the Chersonese during the Peloponnesian War, and Xenophon, in sort of now rather outdated textbook, which I remember from my school days, of the conventional way to describe him, Xenophon was a retired major general, you know, writing these treatises about the art of war and his memoirs and so on. He certainly knew, perhaps rather better than Thucydides, all about it. It's tantalizing, of course, given how much they take for granted, that they don't tell us the things we'd like to know. And we just have to accept the limitations of the evidence. There are no videos, there are no nice grainy, pathy newsreels, World War II style. We've got nothing but what I showed you on the slide, and it is not, of course, a representation of any specific real battle, and it's highly compressed and all the rest of it. There's a lot of unreliable evidence, a lot of references to warfare and this particular type of warfare in the poets, but it's very dangerous, I think, to draw too many inferences from that. There's an overemphasis in our sources on Athens and Sparta. All right, they were the most important of the Greek polis, but they were both, in their different ways, very atypical, and that's one reason why they had so much attention concentrated on them by historians, ancient and modern. You also have to recognize, but again, I don't really want to be drawn into this, as to how far hoplite warfare may have changed over the whole period during which, as far as we know, this was, or something very like it, was the standard equipment. There's this tremendous debate, as far as I know, still raging about the origins of hoplite warfare. Again, I read the last expert who sends me an off-print, and since that's happened to Snodgrass, I think he's absolutely right. And the people he's recently been criticizing, I can't understand how they could recover from the force of his arguments, but for all I know, the battle isn't over yet. And as I was saying before, you know, we don't know what we don't know. All sorts of things may have gone on in other parts of the Greek world during this period, which would modify our view of this kind of warfare. I don't think so, but if challenged, there is no way I or any of the experts could prove it. But what I'd like to do is just, having said all that, is to give you two brief quotations from Xenophon. The first I like because it makes the point which writers on warfare often do. At the end of the day, all that waste of life and bloodshed. And this is Xenophon's conclusion about a particularly fierce Spartan Theban set to in the 4th century BC. It's my translation, and I don't like it. I'll explain why in a moment. But what I think is interesting about it is that it actually tells us, in a way that no other text that I've come across does, what the Greek polis war aims were. Because what Xenophon says, and although as a schoolboy I was brought up to think that his prose style wasn't anything like as good as Thucydides and was really rather sort of boring and pompous and plonking, and actually I think it's a very effective sentence which I've tried to render here. And what he actually says is that neither side had benefited. He just uses three words, which I've had to paraphrase here. The first word is kure, the Greek word simply for place, which means here, in other words, no territory. And I think territory probably is the word. He then says neither polis. And I interpret this as meaning, not, as I said, that you wanted then to lay waste and destroy the enemy's polis, or I'm not even sure that capture is the right word. It was quite enough if you could either neutralize it as an enemy or even bring it over to your side. And there's a whole diplomatic history which runs in parallel with the military history of Greek hoplite warfare in which people change sides in sometimes the most surprising ways. The moral to draw from that is again that it was to some extent the attempt to get people on your side rather than to annihilate them. And then what I've talked about, extension of political hegemony, that's a very familiar Greek word, arche, rule. And again, what you were trying to do as a result of winning in one of these wars, that if you had successfully defeated or at least seriously weakened the army of the opposing polis, then it was an extension of your arche. Maybe they would come over to your side, or at any rate it would have the effect, as I put it just a moment ago, that at least you neutralized them. But now, another little bit of Xenophon, just to make the point of what I was saying earlier about if you did get to grips, literally hand to hand, and the Greek word or phrase which corresponding precisely to that, which crops up over and over again in the text, people getting to grips in hand-to-hand fighting. This is an eyewitness account. It's another ferocious Theban-Spartan battle. Xenophon was there as an observer on the Spartan side, and that's what he saw after the battle. And that conveys it more vividly than any paraphrase could do, what it was like when it really got serious and the front line, or more than perhaps the front line troops on both sides, were slugging it out, armored like you saw, with the weapons you saw and which I described, and that's how it ended up. So no question, it was serious fighting when it came to that sort of thing in that sort of of battle. Now, I hope I've given you enough of an impression so that even those of you who didn't know what a hoplite was at lunchtime today have some sense of what this kind of fighting was. Let me now go into the theory bit for what it's worth. And I'm going to put up what was also circulated with the papers, a little graph, but I think I ought to explain it by telling you what occasioned it. And what occasioned it was a seminar last year, which was marking the retirement of the current doyen of British sociologists, Professor David Lockwood. And I was one of the people asked to give a paper, which I was happy to do. This wasn't in the paper. I put it together at the last minute and put it up on the blackboard in order to elucidate some of the points I was making in the paper, which will be published later this year. And the interesting thing about it is that in that audience, it went down like the proverbial lead balloon. I will use the pointer, I think. Sociologists, or at least those sociologists, they really didn't want to hear about that top line. Prejudice against a sort of caricature, a demonized caricature of sociobiology, isn't as bad as it was 10 or 20 years ago, but there's still, I think, you'd find a consensus, certainly in this country, if you went around the sociology departments of the major universities, that, well, sure, ultimately there's a biological basis, but explaining the diversity of patterns of human social behavior has to be about all the stuff on the bottom line, which is sociology's stock in trade. But nor was that particular audience, as far as I could judge, much interested in this. As far as I'm concerned, that's the anthropologists, to some extent the archaeologists. That's the world of rituals and artifacts and pottery styles and sacrifices and sports and games and pastimes. Thank you very much. They didn't need me to tell them that what's on the bottom line is what sociologists are all about. Now, again, unless people want to in the discussion, and I'm prepared to expatiate on that, but what I really want to do is simply draw your attention to the distinction which I'm going to assume for the rest of the talk on the right-hand side, and one other qualification for reasons to do with the context of when I first devised this. I've used that word because it tends to cause less offense when talking to social anthropologists and sociologists. I am now, after some hesitation, and for the rest of this talk, I'm going to use Dawkins's word means. But having said that, I don't like it. I don't dislike it as much as some people do. Dan Sperber, whom some of you now, some hands raised. You can't see it.
What is the word? The word I'm going to use for the cultural replicators, the second level of selection, is Richard Dawkins's word meme, M-E-M-E, which he coined, I think, in the book The Selfish Gene, in a couple of pages, which almost in passing. And the reason that a lot of people don't like it, including perhaps most persuasively Dan Sperber, whom some of you I'm sure will have heard when he gave a talk in the Darwin seminar series, and he doesn't like it because what it means or what it purports to stand for is discrete units or particles of information which then affect phenotype. And what Sperber and many other anthropologists and sociologists would say is, hang on, that is not what we are talking about. We are indeed talking about things which are transmitted and replicated in cultures, but to Sperber, if I understand him, it's public representations. I mean, he wants to look at whole rituals or works of art and things like that and see them. He's quite prepared to see them as a unit of selection. In other words, he's quite prepared to put the evolution of the behavior in question in analogous terms to the terms of natural selection, but he doesn't like thinking of them as actual bits of information. And in the middle are the authors whom I'm going to come back to in a moment, and whom, as you'll have seen from the synopsis I draw on, Boyd and Richardson, who come out marginally against it, or did then in the book Culture and the Evolutionary Process, again, because they're unhappy about this idea of looking for discrete bits of information. And it seems to me the problem is something of the same. I don't know if there are any psychologists present. If so, I'd be grateful for a contribution in the discussion. But when you talk to psychologists about memory, there's something of the same problem. I mean, if somebody asks me whether I remember what's the capital of Estonia, yes, I'm trying to recover, if I've got it, a bit of information. But if somebody asks me to remember my mother's death, I'm not being asked for items of information. I'm being asked to summon up a whole complex images and experiences and events and my own and other people's reactions to events. And unless my memory is seen in that context, the explanation of why I do or don't remember what I do isn't likely to get very far. But perhaps what I could do is just to read you a short paragraph from the paper which prompted me to try and put that little diagram together. And what I said in the paper was that the three analogous, but I would argue, irreducible levels of selection can be set out schematically. I say that I hope the table doesn't need extended commentary, since although the relation between the three levels in any particular analysis of a pattern of human social behavior may be very difficult to establish, the difference between them is, I think, unmistakable. But let me make clear, by evoked behavior, I'm using evoked in the sense used by evolutionary psychologists. In other words, that's behavior elicited from the human agent, and I'm only concerned here, obviously, with human agents, by a feature of the environment as an instinctive response dictated by a mental algorithm which is a product of natural selection shared by all normal members of the human species. By acquired behavior, I mean acquired in the sense that it's consciously taken from the behavior of another person, or it may be an idealized role model. It depends on individual decisions about the desirability of learning or imitating a taste, habit, fashion, belief, or a way of doing something. And by imposed behavior, I mean imposed in the sense that it's governed by institutional rules which operate independently of the particular role incumbent's choice. For example, capitalists and wage laborers, priests and parishioners, generals and conscripts behave as such, not because they have devised and agreed to the practices which define their roles, but because the roles of which they have become the incumbents, whether willingly or unwillingly, are already institutionalized in their society. So to summarize the difference, and that's all I'm trying to say now, that there is a difference, all human beings can be analyzed as at the same time organisms designed for the replication of our genes, organisms with minds, or if you prefer, brains, designed for the replication of our memes, and organisms with minds designed to be the carriers of the practices which define our roles. And if I could now, just to make a related point, quote directly from what was going to be circulated to you with the synopsis, but it missed the deadline, and that is my forthcoming introduction to the proceedings of the Royal Society British Academy joint discussion meeting organized by John Maynard Smith, Robin Dunbar, and myself, which took place last spring on evolution of social behavior patterns in primates and man, where I make the point, again, taking Dan Sperber as my text, so to speak, that it is very difficult to isolate one level from the other. I say, and I'm now quoting from that forthcoming introduction, just as it's bound to be difficult to disentangle the effects of natural from those of cultural selection, so is it bound to be difficult to disentangle the objects of cultural from those of social selection. And I take Sperber's example when he's talking about pre-literate cultures, and he says, quote, in an oral tradition, cultural representations which are hard to remember are forgotten, unquote. Now, I particularly like that quote because it's a perfect example of what will lead some people who don't like this whole evolutionary approach to say, ha-ha, we always knew it's purely circular. In an oral tradition, cultural representations which are hard to remember are forgotten, ha-ha. But, of course, it's not circular, because to demonstrate it, what you need to do, you need to settle empirically whether formulae which can be shown to be easier to remember are, in fact, transmitted vertically or horizontally within the population under study more frequently than others which can be shown to be more difficult to remember. And since we're talking about archaic and classical Greece, there is a, so to say, a classical example, and that is the transmission of oral epic poetry in that culture, particularly the Iliad and the Odyssey. And it's well known that the replication and diffusion of those two famous long epic poems was facilitated not only by their hexametric form, but by their use of stock epithets and recurring themes and conventional sequences and repeated lines. But, I'm still quoting myself, the mnemonic function of devices like these is far from furnishing an adequate explanation of their remarkable survival and spread throughout the Greek-speaking world. Because whatever the powers of memory enhanced by these devices of non-literate populations, the transmission of long oral epics required training and application on the part of semi-professional singers who had to earn at least part of their living from patrons in whose courts or households they performed when called on to do so. So for all that oral traditions in pre-literate societies are a textbook example of exosomatic transmission from one person's mind or brain to another, they at the same time, and in one move, so to speak, take us into the world of roles and ranks and institutionalized relationships of power and patronage, which is as familiar to archaeologists reconstructing the social structure of non-literate peoples from their grave goods and the spatial distribution of their material remains, as it is to social anthropologists studying them directly in the field, or sociologists and historians studying them through documentary records. So, now, let's get back to the hoplites and say, in these terms, sort of behavior are we trying to get a little deeper into? No question that some aspects of that behavior are grist to the socio-biological mill, that under these headings, some of what went on, and I've included panic because there are some graphic descriptions of what happens when a hoplite army turns and runs, and it's perfectly clear, again, that is evoked rather than required behavior. It's instinctive, if that term is now allowed to be used. Equally, especially in the later period, there's a lot of institutional behavior. I'll give just two examples. The first, which does take me a little beyond, a little later, several centuries later on. Excuse me, I'm just going to put this thing down. I said when you were looking at that representation of hoplite warfare, we don't know to what extent hoplites actually marched in step into battle. If you come much later into the modern period, it is extremely well documented that the invention, or perhaps it was reinvention, of infantry drill had a tremendous impact on the way wars were fought in Europe in the 17th in 18th centuries, and one reason for its effect is that when you do get men marching together in unison, it has this extraordinary bonding effect. And the person who writes about it most interestingly that I've come across, although I think it may strike some of you in this audience as rather naive, but the American historian William H. McNeill, who was actually himself an infantryman in the American Army in the Second World War, he talks about the extraordinary difference made by the introduction of infantry drill in the history of European warfare, and says, quote, "For when a group of men move their arm and leg muscles in unison for prolonged periods of time, a primitive and very powerful social bond wells up among them." And he goes on to say in a footnote, he's talking about what he has experienced himself, and in a very modest way, I could echo that, having been drilled as a national service conscript on the barrack square of the Guards Depot at Caterham in the 1950s. It is extraordinary what happens. And McNeill actually quotes from a text on military matters by the great Maréchal de Saxe, in which he says, he has often noticed, he says, you can't get a man to go on dancing without music for more than 10 minutes. You can get people to dance all night if you get the rhythm going. I'm paraphrasing, of course. And he says he's often noticed how when people are called to the colours, they respond instinctively to the drum beat. So it could well be, and I don't want to underestimate it, that these effects were a very important part of what was actually going on. Equally important could be the institutions within which this kind of thing took place. And again, I'd just like anecdotally to give you one example. It's from fairly late on, it's after the Peloponnesian War, but there's a surviving speech by the Athenian orator Lysias in which he's prosecuting in front of a military tribunal somebody well called Alcibiades Jr., in other words, the son of the so-called great Alcibiades who features in the Peloponnesian War. And the young Alcibiades, if you take the text as we have it of Lysias' speech, is the worst kind of upper-class shit. I mean, he's vain, arrogant, and cowardly, and he's being prosecuted for the offence of lipotaxia. He didn't run away in a battle. He was called out to serve as an infantryman, and he didn't turn up. And the interesting, and some extent amusing thing about this particular example is that in this speech, Lysias anticipates the defence. Because he knows exactly what Alcibiades Jr. is going to say. Alcibiades Jr. is going to say, I don't have to turn up in the infantry, I'm a cavalry officer, unquote. And Lysias says, ha-ha, no good. Because, as Alcibiades Jr. and his council no doubt knew perfectly well, there was another law in Athens at that period, and we don't know how long it goes back, which said that nobody is allowed to turn up when called out in the cavalry rather than the infantry, with the clear implication, it seems to me, that service in the cavalry was the cushy kind of service for the rich kids, like Alcibiades Jr. If you do that, the technical term was adokimastos, and what that means is that you hadn't been passed by a board of scrutineers. So at this late stage in this whole form of warfare, you've got the apparatus of the state is there, imposing, in a very literal sense, this kind of behaviour. There are a formal legal sanctions against people not turning out and doing this kind of fighting if it comes to a battle, which you don't get in the earlier period. But I put a great big question mark under the heading of the acquired behaviour, because that's what I most want to persuade you as being very important and very interesting in the context of a Darwin seminar. And now we come to Boyd and Richardson. Again, I'm very conscious of my own unprofessionalism in this. There was a hope, I gather, that Rob Boyd might have been able to come to this seminar, and I wish he could have, but he can't be in this country, and I may not have got this right. And let me just anticipate an argument which might come from a slightly different flank. You know, what is the point of going into this kind of literature when the data is so poor? I mean, it's absurd to think that sophisticated models of gene culture co-evolutionary theory can actually be brought to bear when we don't know, we have none of the quantitative data, we don't even have the basic demographic data. But the point is, of course, I find it extraordinarily helpful to take from Boyd and Richardson and others the models which they've developed, because it distinguishes the different kinds of processes. And it certainly made me see the evidence I was looking at in a different and to me, very illuminating light. Now, I'm just going to talk about one example where it seems to me that's what it's all about, and then several examples where it seems to me that's what it's all about. And there are the definitions I've taken from Boyd and Richardson. And those who aren't familiar with it, which a lot of you probably are much more than I am, please remember that when I talk later on about indirect bias, what I mean is imitation of the most successful role model. Now, the one bit of all this hoplite fighting...
Harry,
yep?
Why don't you mind reading out the paragraph? They're completely invisible from here.
Oh, Lord.
Oh,
well, you see, if we have a room, I guess you're all supposed to be sitting in the front row instead of skulking at the back.
Could I encourage people to move forward? If I think people in front can read, can't they?
How far back can't people? That's,
I can't read.
Oh, Lord, I am sorry about that. Well, these two. Guided variation. Initial phenotypes are modified by either individual trial and error or social imitative learning, i.e., the alternatives are self-generated. And indirect bias, in the semi-technical sense that Boyd and Richardson give it, is imitation of the most successful role model. Now, one aspect of hoplite behavior, which I haven't touched on, and is in a sense obvious, is that people actually had to learn to handle these weapons. And that's where I think we're looking at an absolute classic case of Boyd and Richardson's guided variation. And I'm just going to preface it, again, to quote deliberately from somebody who many of you will have heard when he was here giving one of these seminars, an extract from Dan Dennett's recent book called Darwin's Dangerous Idea, where in a characteristic jaunty piece of prose, he says, I'll read it out for the benefit of you. So far as I know, he says, in every culture known to anthropologists, the hunters throw their spears pointy end first. But this obviously doesn't establish that there's a pointy end first gene that approaches fixation in our species. Even if some individual hunters aren't bright enough to figure out for themselves that they should throw the pointy end first, they'll be told to do so by their peers. Or they will just notice their practice and appreciate the results immediately. In other words, you don't need a genetic basis for any adaptation that you'll pick up from your friends in any case. A conclusion with which I take it nobody present will disagree. If you do, please tell me during the discussion. Now, I did actually go to the point of really trying to get to grips with this for my own education more than anything else, but because I really can't read it out, it's in smaller type, and some of you may want to get on with the argument anyway. But for the benefit of those of you who automatically think this way, I actually think, if I have got Boyd and Richardson right, that what they formalize in this way really is what was going on in the transmission from successive generations of fighting age males of the techniques of hoplite warfare. But again, we can come back to this in discussion if you like. It would take me too long, and besides, I'm terrified I may have made a mistake. So the sooner I get back to what I'm more comfortable with, the better. Here is the meat of my argument. I ask the question, what then, when we're looking at this style of warfare, are the means? And I'm going to propose four, and I'll just show you what I call them. One, what I call the war is normal meme. Two, the hero of the people meme. Three, the dedication of spoils meme. And four, the guilt, shame, and disgrace meme. And I put in there the Greek word eidos, about which I'll say something more in a moment. Now, war is normal. There's a huge debate among specialists as to how far it was normal in a statistical sense. We have no idea how often these young males actually were called out to do this kind of fighting. We just don't know. No way we can. But one of the experts, whom I quoted at the very beginning, Connor, in an article in the journal Past and Present, makes the point, he says, look, well, it's not the frequency, it's the symbolic importance of warfare in this culture. And I think he's absolutely right. And my own guess would be, and talking to Anthony Snodgrass before, he I think, confirmed this, but again, he may correct me, it's plausible to suppose that as a young male hoplite, although you might quite often be called out and you wouldn't come to a battle, or there might quite often be years in which you weren't called out, you really had to be prepared for it to happen to you and for you to actually be there in the hoplite phalanx, looking into the whites of the eyes of another aggressive young male from the polis on the other side of the hill. And just one text, which I particularly like for a reason which I'll come back to at the very end of the talk. Here's a piece of Aristotle from Aristotle's Politics, picking up a thought which I believe, but I didn't check it, actually is in Plato's Laws, but that's not the point. Aristotle says that he proposes as a good suggestion that the territory of a polis that's privately owned should be divided into two parts, one on the borders and one near the city, and that's perhaps not the right term itself, so that each individual owner has a plot in each part and all have a share in both. This has the merit of satisfying the claims of justice, says Aristotle, and of reinforcing communal solidarity in the face of neighbour town wars. I've deliberately rendered it that way. And astigeitinas is a word which occurs in Thucydides, Herodotus, a perfectly straight classical word, and neighbour town wars seems to me to render it exactly. Point of it, clearly, it absolutely reeks of the fact that everybody, Aristotle's contemporaries, you know, reading that, is expected to think that that is a normal expectation, that you are always, not necessarily doing it every year, but you're always ready for the possibility that you will be in another neighbour town wars with those guys in the other little polis the other side of the hill, even if you aren't being called out in a big war with your allies against the Athenians or the Spartans, let alone the Persians coming over and trying to clobber all Greeks, irrespective of the differences between them. Another classic text, The Hero of the People Mean. Here is Pericles' funeral oration itself. Couldn't resist, I'm afraid, calling it the Mnemi meme. Whole world is sepulcher of famous men, unquote. Every schoolboy used to be brought up on that when I was a schoolboy. But he says in that passage of that famous speech that it's not only, in my translation again, the inscription on monuments in their homeland by which they're commemorated, but in lands other than their own, an unwritten memorial, agraphos, literally unwritten, mnemi, the word for which memorial perhaps isn't the best rendering, I'm not sure, resides not in a work of men's hands, but in every man's mind. In other words, in that culture, everybody knew it was absolutely standard that those who had died in battle were celebrated in inscriptions on monuments, in oral tradition, in the writings of historians, celebrations of poets, and all the rest of it. And that's what I am getting at. Then one poetic quotation to make the point about dedication of spoils. This is from Aeschylus's play, The Seven Against Thebes. The plot, if you don't know, it doesn't really matter, except that it ends in two brothers fighting to the death at one of the seven gates of Thebes. And before the battle, one of the brothers says to the chorus, in their usual way on the stage, this is what I'm going to do. And he says, I vow, when I've defeated my brother and all his mates, that I shall plant trophies and take the enemy's spear-torn garments as spoils with which to crown the pure dwelling places of the gods. Well, apart from that, there is a huge amount of archaeological, as well as other evidence, as the literary evidence, that what you did when you had defeated your enemy, you actually stripped the bodies, sometimes, but not always, if I read the literary evidence right, you actually took off the chiton, which was the undergarment underneath the the shield which you saw represented. But you certainly took the armor, and you very often dedicated it, or the helmet, or something like that, either in your own hometown or at a Panhellenic sanctuary site. And in places like Olympia, thousands upon thousands of such offerings. And of course, it was a way of advertising to the world at large that you had won, that your side had won, or possibly you yourself had behaved particularly heroically. And it's well documented, all sorts of things. So people would inscribe some of these trophies, some of them, say, nail helmets up on posts outside temples at sanctuary sites and all that. And the point is, every young Greek kid growing up, every proto-hoplite, he'd be tremendously aware of this. He would know. He would see panoply in the attic or wherever it was kept. And even if he didn't see his father called out to battle, he'd be brought up on the stories of this. He would see in the temples of his own little polis these dedications and all the rest of it. And finally, what I'm calling the Ido's meme. Here, I don't have a quote for you, but I'm just going to try and summarize what I got from a reading of the predictably subtle and illuminating discussion of the Greek concept of Ido's from the recent book by Bernard Williams. Now, Bernard Williams is, of course, writing from the point of view of somebody interested in moral philosophy, not from what I'm writing about here, but he has some, I think, extraordinarily interesting things to say about the way in which this notion bridged what in our culture are the rather more separate notions of shame and guilt. Now, again, it's obvious and common possibly to warriors in all places and times. There's a whole mythology and culture and everything about cowardice. And in its in sort of classic formulation, you get the term Ido's actually in the Iliad, in one particular passage I'm thinking of, where the Greek Ajax, who's the sort of great big roaring bully boy among the Greeks, you know, shouts out to the other Greeks in a splendid Homeric hexameter, of men who feel or experience Ido's more a saved than die. In other words, it's a straight prudential appeal. Don't be cowardly, because if you run away, you're more likely to be killed than not. But in later Greek literature, it gets increasingly subtle, and in the dramatists. And the distinction, as Williams draws it, seems to be absolutely right in our vocabulary. If you say the sense of shame, what does it make you want to do? I mean, you've done something you wish you hadn't done. How do you undo it? Well, the sense of shame, proverbially, you want to disappear. You want to go up in smoke. You want to disappear into a hole in the ground. You want to cover your nakedness, maybe literally. If you say, well, what in the archetypal case, when you feel guilty, what you want to do, and Bernard Williams says, I think, quite rightly, you want to make reparation. You want to atone for the wrong that you've done to your spouse, your friend, or, of course, your fellow combatant. And Williams also points out there are very interesting relations between the public and the private aspects of this. You can feel ashamed even if you haven't done something. You may be ashamed and maybe entirely inside yourself that you were scared of showing cowardice, maybe. Equally, of course, it can be extremely public. But the point I take from this discussion, very much in the Greek context, is what an extraordinarily powerful pressure must have been exerted on these young Greek males once they were in battle or on the way to the battlefield. And I think here we really can rely on the literary evidence. And you only have to think, if you will, what it must have been like in that kind of fighting. Quite apart from the wanting to be a hero and be celebrated, not wanting to let your mates down, again, that's common in a lot of armies, but there you are. If you break the ranks, and interestingly, there's stuff in the literature about the disapproval of people who break the ranks because they go too far, because they want to show off, because they want to break the front rank, where the promachoi of the front fighters were. If you don't perform well, you have every reason to be absolutely overwhelmed with shame and guilt of every kind. doesn't mean it didn't happen. Even the Spartans did it. Spartans sometimes ran away. I mean, given 5 minutes, and it's all I need. If they did, they lost their civic rights, we think, and there's a word for them. They were known as the Trecenti, as the tremblers, who ran away in battle. But nevertheless, the pressures not to, the psychological pressures, must have been enormous. And now I'm going to end with a part of the story which probably everybody knows some of, which is what happened when Solon went to see Croesus, and Croesus said to him, you know, Mr. Solon, you're the wise man. Who is the happiest man in the world? Herodotus tells this famous story, and Croesus is very pissed off when Croesus doesn't say, you, King Croesus, you know, you're the happiest man in the world, and he ends up saying, call no man happy till he's dead. However, the interesting bit about that story is who Solon said to Croesus when he was pressed, is the happiest man in the world. Well, Solon said to Croesus, the happiest man has ever been was an Athenian called Telos, about whom we know nothing else at all. Who was he? I don't know, this is all we know. And this is Solon telling Croesus why Telos the Athenian was the happiest man who ever lived. First of all, he was citizen of a well-regarded polis, Athens, okay. Second, more grist to the socio-biological mill, he had been very good at maximizing his inclusive reproductive fitness because he had fine, upstanding sons, all of whom have children, and all their children survive. Thirdly, he had enough to live on by Greek standards. Okay, bit of propaganda there. You know, unlike you luxurious Orientals, he was content with his modest means, and by implication, happier as a result. And finally, he had the best possible death. Why? Because he died splendidly in a victorious battle. He was accorded a public burial where he fell, and we know from the sources that that was unusual. You really had to have done well. It was like getting the VC to get a public burial on the spot. And his countrymen honored him greatly. And that, I think, is the text for the acquired behavior I'm talking about, for the culture in which there is transmitted from successive generations, quite apart from between the peer group, these means that I have sought to identify, these units of cultural selection. And I'd, without pushing the argument too far, I would like to suggest that in this particular case, neither a reductionist hypothesis of a sort of hard-nosed socio-biological kind will fit the data such as we have it very well, nor the conventional explanations about constitutions and laws which you would find in the old-fashioned textbooks on the history of Greece. I think we are seeing, leave aside the weapons handling, we are seeing a classic of the transmission over successive generations for several centuries within this defined population, within this distinctive culture, of means by one of the processes which Boyd and Richardson, as far as I know, the first people to try and analyze in that justly influential book, which in my view has not influenced as many people like me, as general comparative sociologists, as it has to. I'd hope to finish, but I won't, with the obvious answer. And why did it break down? In one word, the answer is the introduction, the replacement of citizen hoplites by mercenaries. But that's another story. I'll leave it there, and I'll be very pleased to take any questions. Remembering, I'll particularly direct the tricky ones about hoplites to the chairman, who knows far more than I do.
Well, so far, I think the prediction that the most emphatic and innovatory aspect of the seminar would lie in the cultural field has, I think, been fulfilled. For myself, the most surprising thing that I found that Gary Runciman had said was at the very, very beginning when he dissented from the view that this style of warfare is a peculiar or odd one. And I now see why, because the memes which were listed at the end are, most of them, I think, not at all unfamiliar from other cultures and other styles of warfare. We're all familiar with societies in which war has been very frequent. We're all familiar with the good reputation to be derived from death in battle in other cultures, and from the constraining effect of shame. Would you agree that perhaps the Greek emphasis on dedication of spoils is the oddest of those four cultural memes that you listed?
Well, how can I find it odd, being brought up as I have been, in a culture where there were similar things all over the place? My father used to go to a service every year in Durham Cathedral, where the Auxiliary Air Force Squadron, which he'd founded in the 30s, which then distinguished itself in the Battle of Britain, would have its colour carried up the aisle to the altar, and it would be put up somewhere. I've never seen it. The fact that it took the particular form which it did, and the fact, if anything puzzles me, it's the fact that in what was, after all, not just by our standards, but by theirs, a not very affluent society, this armor was quite expensive, and there's a whole literature on how much it cost, you know, relative to a person's labor or the price of an ox. What is perhaps surprising is that this I think, natural wish to hang the regimental colours in St. George's Chapel after the victory took the form of actually, to use another piece of jargon, the thesaurization, the unproductive removal from the economy of valuable pieces of bronze. But I'd be tempted to say that, you know, that shows just how powerful the culture was.
Yes, I think there's room for debate as to whether standards and colours are the same thing as loot taken from the enemy, but it's time to invite contributions from the audience. And please, may I remind you, when the microphone is brought to you, could you identify yourself? There's no need to speak very loudly. A normal voice will carry.
And please, if there is a psychologist in the house who would be prepared to come in about memes and memories. I don't know if there is.
Here in the front.
Matt Ridley. Hello.
Yeah.
Matt Ridley. Having established your hypothesis on a data poor set of fighting men, could you then transfer some of the ideas, in other words, the central idea that there is a level between the institutional and the biological, as it were, could you then transfer that idea and test it in a more data-rich environment, such as the modern football fan, for example, or something like that? Have you thought of that?
I haven't thought of looking at football fans in the same way as young Greek or any other male warriors. And I'm not well versed in the literature, although of course it is quite well studied, and it goes back a lot longer than some newspaper readers and politicians think. My immediate reaction is that there is an important distinction to be drawn between patterns of social behavior which are to do with what is, under anybody's definition, a leisure activity. I mean, it may be the sublimation of aggression which would otherwise find its outlet on a field of battle. But again, I'm looking at it from the cultural point of view, and the means, to use that word, with which young men are brought up, which are to do with the absolutely core values of patriotism, survival, political independence, and the rest of it. So I would want to be cautious, but that something of the same mechanism may be at work, almost certainly. Very interesting if somebody were to carry out the sort of study which you suggest, yes.
Camilla Power, University College London. Could I put it to you that the only meme you actually, as a result of acquired behavior that you actually identified, was the weapons handling, and that virtually all the others that you were identifying are actually results of social processes, particularly ritual practices put in place by enormously costly, rich, religious, ideological signals. The hero of the people meme, the young Athenians training as ephebes in their long probationary periods before they become hoplites, have all these mythological examples like Jason, the black hunter. They go through experiences that parallel those mythological examples. Dedication of the spoils, it doesn't just happen in any old place, it happens in the religious center of the Greek world, perhaps Olympus, as you said yourself. Eidos, I find it hard to believe that experiences of shame and guilt that acute can be felt except towards men that you share a religious ritual community with, you eat in their mess, you know they're that committed to you. It isn't just a matter of a kind of free-floating meme that you just copy it because it's somebody that you look as a role model, you just imitate them. There are very harsh constraints in place and high costs if you don't perform those behaviors.
Memes aren't free-floating, or those ones certainly aren't, but let me just underline the difference between what I'm calling acquired and imposed behavior. And the actual process of transmission of memes, and I think this would probably apply to other people who would use that term in other contexts, it is from one individual person's mind or brain to another. When you get down to imposed behavior, I would argue, well, I don't want to get into this now, but it is by no means generally accepted, that the units of selection are units of reciprocal behavior. They are practices. Now, this is where, to answer your question fully, I would need to go more deeply into the history. Because as I was saying, by the end, of course, yes, this whole pattern of behavior is tremendously overdetermined by an institutional history, and a lot of the ritual was at that stage highly institutionalized. But let's go back to the beginning of it, you see. Let's go back to where, unfortunately, the data is almost non-existent. And to when calling people out who also had armor to fight with you was an extremely informal business. I mean, we don't know what, if any, ritual, or do we, were practiced and at whose initiative at the beginning of the period of hoplite warfare. But I would be very surprised if there were, and again, I'm talking about the jargon of my own subject, if there were roles like that of the mantis or soothsayer who appears very often in these. There certainly weren't the military tribunals like the one I described prosecuting Alcibiades Jr. And the precisely what I want to get at is the extent to which, if we could isolate separately the influence of the rather more free-floating memes, not free-floating, but they emerge in a context where the evoked behavior is relatively more important. I mean, I have no problem with that a lot of the fighting that went on in those early stages, you know, was the kind of thing which goes on the street in some cities in the contemporary world and is documented for young men of a certain age worldwide, but also where before, historically, never mind analytically, the institutions of the later period are all in place, you do appear to have very early on this cult of the hero, this identity with your own local community, and it appears that people could be called out. Again, I'm going to appeal to Anthony Snodgrass on this. It appears that people could be called out because there certainly were things that look like wars that we know very little about, at the very beginning part of the period, where, put very broadly, social organization was so informal. But can I ask you to come in on that?
I think that's true at the beginning. I think perhaps the heart of this question was a statement you made at one point in your talk, that acquired behavior is the result of individual decisions. And that I would certainly find much easier to accept in the early stages than later, when I would rather agree with the last speaker that it becomes very determined by social constraints.
Somebody at the back.
Yes. At the back first, please.
Bernard Williams. Gary, I don't deny that you can set up analogies between processes of cultural transmission and processes of genetic transmission, which is effectively what the description in terms of memes does. I think I've got a worry I'd like to ask you to expand a bit on, about whether that's the basis of any analogy between an explanation given in these terms and an explanation given in terms of evolutionary or genetic theory. And the reason I have for this is that I take it that the explanation of the existence of a character in a different population, in a given population which is given in terms of evolutionary theory, depends upon, essentially involves the idea of what environmental pressures selected for that character as against the alternatives which were available perhaps at some stage in the proceedings of the population. Now, we have a picture of a society in which certain memes, as you put it, are transmitted. That is, there are certain social and individual characters which are transmitted from one generation to another, right, through a certain learning process. But isn't there a level of explanation still wanting? Namely, what was the feature of the environment of this society which selected for those particular characters? Because one of the things that presumably, when people say it's strange, one of the things they mean is there aren't an awful lot of societies which do just this. Now, the question, therefore, is what is it about round there which led to the selection for, if I may use that expression, precisely this set of memes being expressed in the social behavior. Now, if I can add one remark, it slightly matters what the analogy to the species is. Because, of course, the selection for certain kinds of military behavior in one polis will be influenced by the behavior of another polis. That's certainly true. But, of course, since you're speaking really of the Greek world at this point, it's rather the selection of those behaviors in the whole Greek world as opposed to other military setups elsewhere. And it might look as if one had to go to some other level of explanation in order to answer questions of that form.
I entirely accept that if I were to pursue this in detail, I thought this morning whether I did or not would depend very much on the reception I got this afternoon, does require that, yes. I mean, there are, of course, important disanalogies between, on any version known to me, my own or anybody else's, or Boyd and Richardson, or who you please, between natural selection and any form of social or cultural selection. But that it is, in a more than trivial sense, an evolutionary process that we're looking at, I would be confident of being able to persuade you. And that, of course, is where the notion of replication comes in. And what has to be shown is that these memes are transmitted through successive populations with the possibility of mutation, and that possibility of mutation must enhance the likelihood of their further replication, and that likelihood must be traceable independently to features of the environment. Now, that I would entirely accept. And that's where I agree with the extent to which I didn't dissent from the the earlier question, indeed made the point myself, it is quite extraordinarily difficult to know how to do that, how to disentangle the acquired behavior from the imposed behavior, and to specify, I mean, it's, I'm going to a slight parenthesis, it's actually, I think, a weakness in Dawkins' original argument, because when he says means are selected for the psychological satisfaction which they afford to the person on the receiving end, he says nothing which would persuade the reader that he isn't going to get into, as you might call, a survival of the fittest bind, to be shown that this is a circular argument. So that there's got to be a plausible account which links the presumptive individual psychology of the young male, and then you have the problem of over-determination for evoked behavior, because some people would want to say, well, the basic thing, just put a lot of young men into an environment like this, and the aggro will break out, and all this cultural stuff, which you're giving me, adds nothing to the explanation that comes later. I would have to do that too. Whether I could or not, I certainly can't do it in a sentence, but I have some ideas as to where I would look in the environment. I think I could construct a not wholly implausible story. I wouldn't go further than that.
Another question on the other front, yes. I'm afraid this will have to be the last one before tea.
Well, it's the one I'm most frightened of, so let's
go. Gary, this is not really addressed to your main thesis, but there is, for me, with my background, a curious sort of evolutionary analogy between the situation that you've been describing and one that I have been very interested in animals. And that is that these guys don't actually seem to have been fighting to win. I mean, why didn't they go and sack the enemy's city and take all his inhabitants away to slavery? Why didn't they invent siege engines and so on? And I mean, as you probably know, have been fascinated by the somewhat ritualized way in which animals sometimes fight. There is something peculiarly ritualized about the situation you've been describing. And I suppose that's what people are saying is odd. But I'm wondering whether people understand why it's like that.
Yes, I'm not sure how much it explains for me to say in response to that, that what is striking to me is not once I get into reading the sources on the culture, this very strong sense that it was a culture in what being a warrior was doing well in this kind of combat, and it includes the not doing things which Roman legionaries in particular, who were presumably not only genetically indistinguishable but equally young, equally aggressive and armed with not very dissimilar weapons, did. But I think the kind of purely ritual threat, well known to yourself and others in the study of animal behavior, I don't actually see there. Because when these young men are called out, and when they don't kill as many of each other as you might expect, it does appear to be either, well, probably both. One lot run away to save their own skins, as they hope. And we get back to the actual practicalities of this kind of warfare. The Spartans pretended that they never followed up in pursuit because they were too proud. But actually, it wasn't a very sensible thing to do unless you had a lot of cavalry who could do it easily. There wasn't much in it. You would expose yourself. I mean, it was actually quite difficult. If you'd had a Greek general, a strategos, who was a sort of proto-bloodthirsty, you know, Roman legionary commander, and you put him back into that period, it was a slightly absurd thought experiment, but it's the best I can do, I think he would have had a tough time. And it obviously isn't, so there isn't a natural selection explanation that I could see that would be remotely possible. But in this case, it is some features of the weaponry, some features of the environment, and some features of the culture, and how do we disentangle them, which does convey a picture of the fact that it wasn't purely ritual bluff and threat. But there were some reasons, which I say I wish we could disentangle, why the casualty rates and the intention to inflict further casualties were as relatively low as they were.
Well, with that, and perhaps with the phrase glorious conspiracy from the first quotation that Gary used, ringing in our ears, can I now cordially invite everybody to tea in the foyer? We should be back in here in about 25 minutes, I hope. Is that all right, Helen, given that we began everything a little bit late?
A particular interaction within that relationship. Furthermore, at each level, we use different explanatory concepts. So that, for instance, if you ask why two siblings are fighting over on a particular occasion, you might say because they both want the same toy. That's at the interaction level. But if you're asking why they're always fighting at the relationship level, you'd use a concept like sibling rivalry or something of that sort. Furthermore, each of these levels affects and is affected by the level on either side. So that what goes on in an interaction depends on the nature of the individual and on the relationship in which that interaction is embedded. What goes on in any relationship depends, of course, on the constituent interactions and on the group in which that relationship is embedded, because A's relationship with B is affected by B's relationship with C, and so on. Furthermore, at each of these levels is affected by and affects the physical environment, which I shan't discuss, and the socio-cultural structure. And by the socio-cultural structure, I'm combining the two levels used by Gary Runciman of both the socialization and the institutions. So I'm including the values, the myths, and the institutions in the society in which the individual grows up. And I'm not sure that the two levels to which he refers can easily be separated, but that we can perhaps discuss. Now, the point I want to emphasize is that these dialectical relations between levels and with the sociocultural structure are continuous. And that means that one can't think of any of these levels as entities. Even the individual is not an entity, but is in a continuous process of creation, maintenance, or degradation through the agency of these dialectical relations between levels. That, in its turn, makes it difficult, in my view, to make clear distinctions between biological behavior, acquired behavior, or imposed behavior. Because nearly every behavior depends on genes, on the environment, and on the culture. War is a societal characteristic. We have to ask how individual propensities operate to make war possible. And to address that question, I'm going to consider aggression at three levels of social complexity. First of all, let's consider a very simple example of individual aggression. Take two boys fighting over a toy. Their aggressiveness, or their fighting, is due perhaps to three propensities, let's say. They have a tendency to behave aggressively. They have a tendency to acquire the toy. And they have a tendency to show off to their peers and bystanders who are watching. Their status in the group matters. Now, those three propensities may be combined in different proportions, so that this diagram represents the situation in which, supposing there were only these three propensities, we could account for this aggressive incident only in terms of these three propensities, then aggression might occur anywhere above the striped surface in this three-dimensional graph. Furthermore, every act of aggression brings you liable to retaliation, And so fear is involved too, and we have to take that into consideration. So the various types of aggression that one gets, and this slide may not be very visible at the back, but it's four types of aggression that school children show. And this slide shows a number of different types of aggression that you see in adults. Instrumental aggression, aimed at getting a particular object or situation. Emotional aggression, which is hot-blooded and angry. Felonious aggression, committed in the course of a crime. Bizarre aggression, which is psychopathic. And dissocial aggression, which is aggression that is acceptable in the context of the group in which it's, the subgroup in which it's given, that may not be generally acceptable. These different types of aggression can be seen as consequent upon the relative strengths of the different propensities that are involved. Now, I want to say a word or two about the development of the propensity to show aggressive behavior. First of all, within the family, there are a variety of influences that have been identified as rendering individuals more likely to show aggression. First of all, there are genetic influences. There's conditioning. Aggressive acts may be rewarded. There is observational learning. They see other people being aggressive and imitated. There are the effects of punishment, which are effects of punishing children for aggression are very complicated. And although they might lead to a cessation of aggression in the particular context in which it was punished, it probably results in more aggression elsewhere. And there's also clear data showing that the balance between parental control or parental strong control and parental warmth is an important influence on the likelihood of the children showing high aggression in school or elsewhere. Furthermore, there are influences from outside the families. There are the role models that they have, either older children or, as I show there, also in the media. And they're the societal norms of the society in which they live as part of the sociocultural structure. Then there are influences which predispose them to aggressive acts in the particular context in which the aggression occurs. Again, societal norms may operate that this is a situation in which aggression is acceptable. Aggression is more likely with population density, with high arousal. The Watts riots in San Francisco were blamed on the long, hot summer, and of course their personality issues too. And finally, there are eliciting factors that actually are responsible for the appearance of aggressive acts. Now, why go through all this is simply to make the point that the instance of a simple aggressive act depends on a very complicated web of causal factors. I want to emphasize the importance of ontogeny. And I want to ask the Darwinian question of, it seems to me that it isn't good enough to say that aggression is selected for or not selected for. That's the sort of only a very superficial thing. What we want to know is which of these mechanisms that lead to aggression are adaptive and which are not. Now, let's move a step on and look at aggression between groups. And I want to say a word or two about why groups form. Again, I don't think it's quite enough to say that human beings have a propensity to form groups. We want to know what are the mechanisms involved. One thing that's important in humans, but not in other species, is that as part of our need to feel, to perceive that we're controlling our world, we need to have a coherent world view. And many of the things that we think about the world, we can never know that they're true or not unless we can find somebody else who thinks the same. And our only way of verifying many of our beliefs is by finding somebody else who agrees with us. And therefore, we are attracted to people who think in a similar way to the way in which we think. And that can give rise to a group loyalty. Now, an adult group has certain characteristics. First of all, the members of that group define themselves as a group, and they see themselves as interdependent, and they evolve rules and norms which guide their behavior. There is an argument in the social psychological literature as to what is primary. Is it primary that they see themselves as similar and define themselves as a group because they're similar? Or do they define themselves as a group because they see themselves as being interdependent? I don't think that matters too much in the present context, but it is, in the terms of Darwinian selection, it's proper to ask whether the second and third issues there, the interdependence and the elaboration of rules and norms, arise from the definition of a group, or whether the definition as a group and the interactions mediated by rules arise from the feeling of interdependence. Now, as a consequence of group formation, the individuals within the group acquire a social identity. We all have a complicated social identity. We see ourselves as male or female, as black or white, as conservative or Labour, and so on. Membership of a group contributes to your identity. And you identify with groups that you perceive favourably, and you perceive favourably groups with which you identify. Furthermore, you tend to perceive fellow members of your group favorably and distinct from members of the outgroup. Again, this is a mechanism which has many repercussions in social life, quite apart from the context of war and aggression. And as a consequence of these facets of group formation, you tend to see the people in the group, the members of your own group, as more similar to yourself than they really are, and you tend to see outsiders as more different than they really are. Group cohesiveness is thereby enhanced, and again you get the elaboration of the sociocultural structure of the rules and norms and socially acceptable explanations to being beastly to other people. And that's a consequence of group formation. Now, when you have aggression between small groups, there are a number of factors that exacerbate the aggressiveness. One is the assertiveness in which you want to show off to the other members of your group. And a lot of the evidence from aggression in mob situations shows that a critically important factor is the members of the group showing off to each other who's the most daring, who can first throw a brick at the police or whatever it is, and that the response of the other side is critical, because if the other side responds, then the throwing of the brick is reinforced, as it were, and the thing is the more prone to escalate. There's also, in a small group, the arousal that comes through being in close contact with peers and the relative anonymity, so that you can do things, your social responsibility is reduced, you can do things because you're doing them as a member of the group and not as an individual. Furthermore, in small groups, there tends to become a leader. if all the individuals, supposing that this is a group that's protesting or fighting because of its too low wages or something of that sort, there's a need for access to resources, and then some people can take the role as leader, and others will take alternative strategies. Now, here, leader in this sort of context, the leader-group dynamics become very important. Leaders are chosen because of their charisma. They're liable to be chosen because of their charisma, but they're liable to have values that are the group's values, or else they impose their values on the group. And in the course of an escalating conflict, the leader's decisions matter, and the leaders may use the out-group to increase the coherence of the in-group, so that by labeling the police as dirty so-and-sos, then the coherence of the in-group is increased. There's another issue about groupthink, which I'm not going to go into. Now, on the other side, and I want to emphasize this, the followers may have many different sorts of motivation for being involved. This is a very interesting analysis done by Professor Straker at Johannesburg about the people who took part in the conflicts in South Africa before the end of apartheid. And she found that this is the so-called youth of South Africa, but youth could mean anything up to about 35 or so. And there were, of course, the leaders who were well-balanced, idealistic, and skillful people. But then there were several other categories of individuals. There were the followers who wanted to be heroes. They were searching, Professor Straker describes them as searching for a script and attempting to achieve an ideal ego. Then there were those who lacked a sense of self, and we used the group to define themselves. There were people who were simply conformists, who just wanted to be with everybody else, didn't care about the ideals, went along with the violence of the group, enjoyed the camaraderie of the group, but weren't motivated by the same motivations as the leaders. And there were also, of course, in these groups, psychological casualties who used the group as an opportunity to show antisocial behavior. The point I'm trying to make is that the composition of these groups, of any small group of this sort, is very complicated and involves individuals who are motivated in many different ways. And we're beginning to get rather a long way from just simple aggression. I should say that in these groups in the South African townships, the situation was exacerbated by the governmental use of television, which was very subtly done, in which the crowd was portrayed as having no clear political goals, and they were portrayed as agitators, with the police actions portrayed as defensive, and there was the television pictures that were shown were accompanied by smoke and fire and music and other symbols of unrest, which made the thing seem much more chaotic than it might otherwise have done. Well, now let's come on to the question of war. And war in the context of the type, which are, of course they're all gradations of war between small groups and complex international war. And I'm talking about international war as we see it now, as we saw it, let's say, in World War II, which involves complex societies in which the leaders, the role of the leaders is the thing that really matters. The role of the leaders is absolutely paramount. And the whole combat is institutionalized, and I'm going to explain what I mean by that in a moment. Now, war is horrible, and when it happens, the vast majority of people involved wish that it hadn't. And so we've got to consider really two problems. One is, why do those who find themselves involved in war get involved and stay involved? And second, why do we let wars happen? Well, now, I'm going to argue that war is not to be explained, as some of my biological mentors have claimed, as a direct product of instinctual forces. People like both Lawrence and Freud have argued that. Nor can it be explained simply as the expression of human aggression. Aggression does not cause war, but wars cause aggression. Let me get back to the question of an institution. And for those of you who aren't social scientists, let me just explain what I mean by an institution. Marriage is an institution with husband and wife as roles. And there are certain things that husbands and wives are supposed to do and other things that they're supposed not to do. And we talk of people being married only in name if they don't do some of the things that they're supposed to do. Parliament is an institution with a prime minister, cabinet ministers, a voting public, and so on. And each incumbent in those roles has rights and duties as a consequence of filling those roles. Now, in the same way, war is an institution. And there are many roles in war, not just soldiers, sailors and airmen, but politicians and transport workers and nurses and doctors and munition workers and railway workers and so on. And we've got to see war, therefore, as an institution in which people are motivated not primarily by aggressiveness, assertiveness, or acquisitiveness, but by their duty in the institution of war. So let's get back to the first question. Why do those involved in war not get out of it? Why do they let themselves get involved in war? And this is the question, I think, that Gary Runciman was addressing in the latter part of his talk. Fear, of course, is an important issue in any active combat, and people in action are afraid most of the time. They stay, I think, for a variety of reasons. Sorry, then I've lost a slide somewhere. Yeah, never mind. Can I just try the next one? I've lost it. I thought I had on a slide these reasons for staying involved, namely the issue of group cohesion. They have a loyalty to the group to which they belong. We have here the whole issue of male bonding, which some sociobiologists have talked a great deal about. There is the fact that in the Korean War and in the Vietnam War, the buddy relationship was given great priority in the American forces, and people were encouraged to form buddy relationships, and there are many examples of people going to pieces if anything happened to their buddy. The second issue that keeps people in the conflict, as it were, is the value structure erected by leaders in their own interests, and that's augmented by propaganda, which I shall come back to in a minute. There is the dominant subordinates way in which the military organizations are structured. There are the religious appeals, which are often very important. And there is the, I think not very important, but sometimes important, excitement of aggression. Aggression can be instigated by fear. And there are rare examples, for instance, in the My Lai massacre in Vietnam. The American soldiers afterwards described themselves as going berserk and said, "I just wanted to kill, kill, kill in the excitement of the moment." There's a terrible tape of their reflections afterwards. Now, it's at this point that I might make a comparison with Gary Runciman's four memes of accepting war as normal, I think was the... Is that how you put it? Second of the hero meme, the spoils of war meme, and the cowardice meme. Well, I think the cowardice meme comes within the subordinates and value structure that I referred to. The spoils of war meme is not really very important nowadays. The hero meme, I would doubt whether it played very much part. I mean, there are occasional instances, but for the vast majority of people involved in the war, it plays very little part. People get singled out afterwards as heroes, but I don't think they're really motivated with a desire to be heroes very often. Let me then come to the second question of why we let wars happen. And the issue here is, what are the forces that support war as an institution? If war is so horrible, and we have war as an institution, what are the forces that maintain it and support it? Well, I think you can classify them really into three groups. First of all, they're everyday factors that make war seem ordinary. And one of these is the war metaphors we use in everyday speech. We talk of going over the top or outflanking a rival or something of those sort, which are war metaphors which have come to us over the generations from cavalry warfare and trench warfare and so on. And we now accept them as part of our everyday speech. Not very important, perhaps, but in the same way as the feminist movement has made us remove a lot of metaphors from our everyday speech, I hope that one day warisms as well as sexisms will disappear. The other things I've got there, the war novels, the war films, really depend on propensities for group cohesiveness. They play on either group values or assertiveness or aggression on basic human propensities which they are using to maintain the interest of the reader or of the person who's looking at the film. The war toys help to introduce children to the mechanics of war, and again, help them to see war as a normal part of human activity. There are certain countries in which war toys are banned, of which Finland is an outstanding example. We haven't yet achieved that in this country. Male chauvinism, I think, is important. The illustration I have, it is a wonderful quotation from an American Marine colonel who, in discussing whether women should be allowed in the armed forces, is recorded as saying, "After all, you've got to keep the essential manliness in war." And then there are the educational issues of, and I'm talking about ways in which we teach history and so on. Then the next group of issues are pervasive cultural factors that help to maintain the institution, the national traditions concerning the recognized role of the country in war. Some countries have aggressive traditions. Others, like Sweden, have changed from being aggressive countries to being very peaceful ones. And many of the issues here play on, again, on group motivations in individuals, because the history of the country involves inculcating a feeling in people that they belong to a group that goes back through history. And by teaching about the sufferings that the population has undergone in previous times, there is a sort of diachronic transference of pain which makes it seem relevant because of these group group coherence to the current generation. There's a very interesting example of that in Cyprus, where I understand on two sides of the road in Nicosia, there's a Turkish museum and a Greek Cypriot museum, each tracing the history of the country, starting at different points, each showing the agonies that the Turks and the Greeks respectively have been subjected to by the other side, many generations in the past. Religion, I don't need to say any more about, except to say that it's been on both sides, of course, against the institution of war and for it. But during time of war, even Christian religion plays goes along with the game as it's being played. And I heard the present Bishop of Ely give a very interesting talk in the way in which the idea of Christ's sacrifice on the cross had been used to bolster up the institution of war. And he had a very dramatic example of a poster with a soldier lying at the foot of the cross with a neatly sanitized bullet hole just there, neatly equating the two. International law, in a sense, aids the institution of war because it recognized it. And up till the end of the Second World War, it did designate particular situations in which war was permissible. There's the question of patriotism and nationalism, which again have their sources in basic biological propensities, in relatively stable characteristics. The cooperation with kin, which the sociobiologists will be very happy to take on board, the group processes to which I've referred, and the societal norms and values which arise from those group processes. In an interesting series of experiments by Feshbach in the United States, he's shown that patriotism and nationalism can be separated, patriotism being love of one's own nation and nationalism being the denigration of other nations. And in experiments done actually shortly before the end of the Cold War, he showed that people who were high on patriotism were less hawkish about nuclear weapons, but more willing to risk their own life, whereas those high on nationalism were hawkish about nuclear weapons, but less willing to get involved themselves. And when you think about propaganda, when you think about propaganda, it depends on, again, the playing on the basic propensity for aggression, on group characteristics, on fear of strangers, because the propaganda always involves portraying the enemy as evil and subhuman and so on. Well, then this is the third set of forces that maintain war as an institution. What Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex, and I think it's better called the military-industrial-scientific complex. And that is, it's beyond my competence to analyze this, but it clearly depends both, they clearly depend both on basic human propensities of assertiveness. The scientists want to do well in their profession by inventing more and more horrible weapons. Each member of each industrial firm, each member of each unit in the army tries to achieve the ideals and norms set by the group to which they belong. And there are more complicated relations between them at a political level. The Cilla Elworthy in Oxford has done a very interesting analysis of the way in which weapons are ordered in this country, showing the inertia of the committees and the way in which political ambitions of the politicians and the relations between the politicians and their electorate lead to the escalation of the weapons that are used. Well, finally, oh, that was the slide that got out of place of the way in which propaganda depends on basic human propensities. So I come back to that slide, and I want simply to argue then that war is to be seen as an institution which depends on these continuing dialectical relations between levels, so that in order to understand war, you've got to understand the forces that maintain it as an institution, as well as the forces that maintain individuals to go along with the institution, and that those forces cannot be simply reduced to biological modules, because you've got to examine the way in which those modules interact and give rise to the socio-cultural structure. We must not see the institution of war or any other aspect of the culture or of any other institution as something out there and a given. It's being continuously created by the interactions between these different levels. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Robert Hind. I think this talk has been salutary in bringing home to us the difference between war and individual or even group aggression in its dependence on a different and wider range of factors. In this second discussion, for which we have more time, which would, for example, enable anybody who wanted to raise questions arising from Gary Runciman's talk as well, also to revive their question now. In this second discussion, we are proposing an experiment of not using the handheld microphone, unless anybody's speaking voice really necessitates it, in order to give greater fluidity to the discussion and in order to enable more people to take part in it. Could I, however, ask you once again, if you want to speak, in this case, I think definitely to stand up and identify yourself when I give the signal to you. Yes, here in the front.
John Watkins, Big Office. I think that if you take the dramatic case, and I think the First World War is probably a paradigm of what looks like systematic mad behavior and the end of people knowing now and now and so. But one thing to notice is that it is a kind of sort of episodic character. And a bit uneasy about these, they all make it these sort of structural explanations that it ought to be something that's going on sort of all the time. If it applies at all, then why isn't it always applying? Whereas these things break up. And I think that when there is a sort of collective group apparent madness, it's a very good methodological principle to assume, you may be wrong, but to assume that the actual people involved in all this are each of them sane and rational, that they're in special situations which somehow, I mean,
I don't think there's any real difference between us. What I'm talking about are the bases on which people make rational decisions. Now, if I can be personal for a moment, as a young man of 18, I was swayed by the propaganda that said, join the Air Force, you can get in at 17 and a half, which was earlier than any other service. I was swayed by the fact that the Battle of Britain was going on, and the propaganda was that our wonderful boys in blue had done all this, that, and the other. I was swayed by the fact that some of the people senior to me at school were already dead. Now, these were all the sorts of issues that you're talking about. Part of what you're talking about was the decisions made by politicians, which are an entirely different issue, but one of the things that's very relevant to that is the fact that they had been subjected to a quite different view of war, even after the Boer War, of not realizing how bloody unpleasant it was. Of course all wars are episodic, but the feeling of being involved in the war is continuous, so that in the First War the people who were temporarily out of the trenches were still apprehensive of going back again. The air crews who were flying every few days were still feeling a sense of group coherence during those intervening days and worrying about what was going to happen at the end of them. I don't think there's any real contradiction between us.
Could I just ask, was that last question audible to everybody? Well, let us then continue with the experiment. Yes, Gary Ransom.
Are you asking between the different sorts of warfare, or
between wars in which the people who are taking the decisions to prolong are themselves combatants?
Well, of course there is a continuum between, and I didn't go into this, between the tribal warfare, as I would call it, in which everybody is involved on more or less equal terms, through stages in which they're ringleaders, two stages in which they're generals remote from the war. What bothers me about what you've just said is that you imply that I'm dismissing the idea of memes. I'm unhappy about the concept of memes in the way in which you used it. But I am arguing that there are these relatively stable characteristics that are very important, which are roughly equivalent, are the sorts of things that you're talking about. What bothers me about the way in which you use the term memes, and I'm not up to date in Dawkins, but I think in the way in which he does too, is that memes are not just bricks that are sort of passed from one person to another. They have to fit into the background of that person's psychological makeup before they're accepted. And so you can't think of them as just chunks that are pushed through the population. And I think this is one of the problems with, I'm a great admiration of Robert Boyd and Richardson too, but I think it's one of the problems with their approach, as I understand it, is that you've got to think of the acceptability of a meme, just in the same way as you've got to think of whether a gene fits into the gene complex into which it's placed.
Yes.
Well, first of all, about Margaret Thatcher, I said male chauvinism, and she was a very male woman. You've got to make a distinction between gender and sex. Over Bosnia, I would guess that you're probably in a better position to talk about it than I am, but I can only surmise that there are group loyalties to the regiment and so on, which are very important in this context. So in a sense, the loyalties come from a more limited institution than the country as a whole. Now, whether that's correct or not, I don't know. Would you agree or not? I don't want to underestimate for a moment the importance of the camaraderie and the cohesiveness of loyalty to the unit and so on that is involved in war. And if I can say another personal anecdote, this will shock you. I've been a member of ex-servicemen CND, and we used to have meetings in Cambridge of members of this organisation. About a dozen of us used to come. And what did they want to talk about? The war, of course. They wanted to swap war stories. And it's a very important issue, and it's such a crucially important period in people's lives, too.
Yes.
I'm not saying he's an instant bottom, but what I think is wrong in this discussion is that the general is being talked about as though he was something outside the institution. He's just a puppet who's got a role in this institution, and he sees himself as having the job of ordering, that his duty is to order the armies and this, that, and the other. He's just part of the whole outfit.
Yes.
So on what Kim just said earlier, the more effective product, and perhaps this is never before, which seems to be very horrible, and as they said, the data in the end. But I'm wondering whether the hoplite law is not in fact more typical of what law really is. In other words, law is considered the process that most nations indulge in most of the time. We have been at war with France in most factories from since the Middle Ages right up to the beginning of the 19th century. But it wasn't.
Well, it may be a good thing for some people, but it's not a good thing for most people. And one of my points about that diagram is that people rise to power and control other people and manipulate other people for their own good, against their own good. And because war is continuous, it doesn't mean to say it's a good thing. We want to get to the bottom of it and understand why it happens. There was something else you said that I didn't agree with. I'm sorry, it's gone. Yeah, but that doesn't mean it's a good thing. Oh, well, if you're saying it's an economic necessity, is Robert Neal still here? He was here earlier on.
Yes.
Yes, he is. You want to say anything about that? No, but you did say in the lecture that you thought that the economic consequences of war, one way or the other, that people didn't fight wars for economic reasons or something of that sort.
Oh, you were referring, Robert Neal, a paper I wrote for a different time, which was when wars were fought for purposes of territorial acquisition. Was there much point in taking territory? And clearly, if you take over more territory and in some degree exploit it, whether under a feudal system, getting sold without it by giving off parents' land or whatever it was, you're quite tough. And that has decreased drastically the industrialization, where production is not based on the use of natural resources, not manufactured or imported. But it remains in particular areas, and most particularly in the case of areas that are very rich. And in particular oil. And the Gulf War is a good example of foreign territory in Asia, even to my territory, was the critical killer of oil and the particular issue of gold. And now, really, the economic preservation of that time, principally around natural resources. That's quite a different thing from the other argument, which.
Yes.
Robert, two questions related to one another, one that we said and the other. The more narrow question is, I'm not sure whether I understand the idea that war is an institution. It doesn't seem to be terribly either like marriage or like parliament. That is, it's not something that's always there, which you can use as a facility or negate.
special case of that, namely when it's directed against another group so organized. But I mean, the one confession that was whether my average mind is something that a military operation, perhaps a police operation, for that divine, the policing is itself a form of organized violence, that is one side war. And I wonder therefore whether there is a general category of war which should be so analyzed as opposed to a phenomenon of socially organized and directed violence. Now, the way that one further remark to that is that one use of the slightly suspect universal category is that under the kinds of glory others, there was a certain tendency to think that war per se was a good thing, a glorious thing, against which the period of two world wars, the American Civil War, and so on, we have reacted, not totally unreasonably, by thinking that war as such is a bad thing. Now, then you have to ask, and we have been suggesting whether you believe that all socially organized violence is a bad thing. That might be quite a difficult thing to say yes to, and then you're an anarchist.
Well, over to your first point about whether war is an institution, I think it's useful to think of war in those terms in order to get away from either personifying it, personifying two countries as being combatants, or talking in terms of the role of instinctive aggression in war, or any of those other ways in which war has been treated. This is a useful way of talking about war, and it's like marriage and it's like parliament, in that there are a lot of different roles involved, and people are motivated primarily by the duties incumbent on their roles. So that's my first point. The second point is, it seems to me it's you that's being sloppy about the category. You're dragging in all sorts of other sorts of violence, institutionalized violence. I tried to be fairly specific in what I meant by international war by saying that it involved complex groups, the role of the leaders was paramount, and that people acted out of a sense of duty. It was institutionalized in that way. And this distinguishes it from many forms of tribal warfare, for instance, and from the violence in the South African townships and so on. Of course there's a continuum. Read Haas's book on the anthropology of war. I mean, there are all sorts of gradations and complexities. And war is a convenient label which I've tried to define in a specific way. And I'm not saying it has anything to do with peacekeeping or with police actions or anything else. That came from you, with all due respect. It can be, yes, I would say it can be, in this sense. But, I mean, it's just, I'm just putting up a category. I don't believe in absolute categories of this sort. This is a socially constructed category which I'm constructing in a particular way.
Can I just, do you want to make one? I mean, the point is, it isn't meant to be just a verbal definition of the point. That's the point. You see, we look at the horrors of the First World War, and everybody's saying, how could this happen? How could this irrational monstrosity occur? But I'm suggesting we look at a wider category of socially organized and structured violence. The general question, how can this monstrosity happen, is the right question to ask. Quite a lot of socially structured and organized violence necessary and justified. The question is, what forms of socially structured and organized violence are in what ways not justified? And are they particularly not justifiable when the two parties involved are both organized and belong to something like different groups, different nations, or something like that?
Yeah, you can ask your own questions. I was asking a different question, you see. I was asking, what are the bases of these non-justifiable activities that fall within this definition of war, and what's the basis of them? You can go off and ask anything else you like. But.
So that your category of war as an institution has a very important definitional role.
Yeah.
It is the property of being institutionalized which makes it a war.
Well, especially, they call it the institution of independence.
No, I think war is continuously there as an institution, as a possibility, in the same way as marriage is always there as an institution, as a possibility. You don't have to be married all the time. We better not pursue that one, John.
Well,
it's made to be active, if you like, or something of that sort, but it's there sleeping all the time. You have conscription, Jonathan, during peacetime. This is part of the institution of war.
At the back, please.
Well, my only comment is this, that there's a German called Goebel who's written very interestingly about the use of the media in war, and what he has documented in great detail is the extent to which the governments control the media, so that when the American Marines landed in Mozambique or wherever it was, the cameras were on the beach ready for them before they landed. To see them going ashore, and he has shown how many, many, many of the pictures that you see are posed pictures. So it's a complicated set of controls. I would terribly hope, can I just say this, and I'm not allowed to ask questions, but I would like to hope that John Maynard Smith or somebody would bring this back to the means question, because that seems to me to be central to what we've both been saying, is to whether you really can talk about modules and means, or whether you've got to think in terms of these dialectics, as I would think, and can't make a clear separation between imposed behaviour and so on. But I don't know whether anybody's willing to take that up.
Yes, but first I think over on the far side here.
You said so much, I haven't got it all, but you said the body politic and invading the body politic, and the point is that there are some people who have other people in their power, and that doesn't mean that because you can't change the way in which the people in power act, that what you want to do is not adaptive. It may be very adaptive for you, but it's not adaptive for them. And they have you where they want you.
Yeah. I suppose on a national level, let's say you have states and they have social systems which are possibly the same as this system. If one specifically sets up a social system which doesn't have a factory, doesn't do all these other things, how will that then survive in relation to all the others? If this is a bad thing, which is what you're implying, then that other, that mutant state, that social system ought to invade all the other systems and they should become extinct.
Well, now we're talking in terms, we're getting into group selection terms, and whether or not that operates in the case of human war. And I know there are people who hold that view, and I really don't know what the answer is there. Does anybody have a view on that? I mean, it is said that this is the one context in which, or one context in which group selection works. John, for God's sake, say something. Yeah, well, that's actually part of my point. I mean, that is exactly what I'm saying to Dr. McManus, that... I think it's true, actually, yeah. And I just happen to feel that science is not, should not be the art of the soluble. It should be the art of what's important. This is an important problem. And it's just because society is complicated that I am unhappy about these sorts of simple, Dr. McManus's sort of simple questions. I know how you can be frivolous from the first time I ever met you, so we won't go into that.
I now have three hands raised at the back. I think there is time to take them and also to take the further question that Gary had. Could we start there on my left, your right?
Shout. Again, you've got to point to the complexity of society. There have been occasions in which it's been in the interests of religious leaders to foster war. There have been occasions, I'm sure, in which it's been in the interests of generals to foster religion. And there's no simple answer to the question that you ask. I wish that we had the Crusades. There was a very interesting article by a professor of ecclesiastical history in Cambridge, whose name just escapes me, but perhaps somebody else can tell me.
Riley Smith.
Riley Smith, yes. On exactly this issue in the Crusades and how much, to what extent they were really religious wars and to what extent other motivations were involved, and very importantly, how those participating saw themselves as seeking salvation by the privations that they suffered and the money that they expended in going out to the Holy Land.
Middle at the back, please, very briefly, if you would. Sorry, I'm talking about the far back.
Diagram doesn't say anything about hierarchy. First of all, do you doubt that society tends to be hierarchically organized and that some people control others?